Top of the top, top of the morning. Welcome to the Bedroom to Boardroom podcast. This is your host, AJ. Throughout this podcast, we'll be sitting down with people from our community who are making moves, really deep diving into their success stories, understanding their background, their trials and tribulations, things they've had to overcome, really with the focus of, you know, motivating a new generation, hopefully giving you some tangible insights for you to actually act on. So nevertheless, you know, stay tuned.
Hello. I don't know. Hello. How's it going? Well, the sound's gone.
Ooh. Good. Give me 1 second.
Sure.
Okay, sorry about that. Sorry.
No worries. How's the day been?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Perfect. 1 second, I'm going to use my phone. Hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time.
No, thank you for inviting me.
So there really is like no format. I mean, there was a format, but I've kind of threw it out the window because I didn't really enjoy it. I've kind of just always enjoyed the more casual, laid back conversation where, you know, I get to know you, get to know how you think, get to know about your working history and just history in general. So that's kind of going to be the layout for today.
Okay.
So I guess
that sounds good.
One of the most interesting things is the accent and like your work history. So I'd love to get to know a little bit more about you from maybe where you were born. And yeah, let's probably start there.
Yes. Sure. And just hold on because you're cutting a little bit. It seems like, I'm sorry about that, but it seems like my internet today is being.
It's okay. I'll just turn my video off.
Can you, if you hear me well, but like if sometimes I cut, just like put it on the recording, but hopefully it will be fine enough. But yeah, obviously, like to answer and the accent. So the accent is definitely a French one. Mm-hmm. I'm a French speaker. My background is a little bit varied. So I'm originally from Congo. Mm-hmm. I'm a mix of Congo and Portugal. But I was born in Congo, Kinshasa. Okay. I grew up, I spent my childhood there. And then I moved to Belgium. And then I spent a lot of years in Belgium until after college. And after that, I've been living in various countries. So I've lived in Congo, in Belgium, in Spain, in Colombia, in Panama, in New York, and now in London.
So I must say, like the first thing when you think of when I heard Congo and then Belgium, is you think of King Leopold and the history of Belgium and the Congo. Growing up, how did that impact you? Were you aware of that?
Yes, I was aware of that. We always were aware of that. Like it's still very, you can still very much feel it first because Belgium and Congo still have a very tight relationship, and it's an interesting one because it's a good and bad relationship. It's like friends and foes. And so we always are aware, we know of our history, at least I'm sure I know, and I think most people there do know, and everybody is aware that like the Belgium colonizer were not like the most gentle. So it did, I think it did affect me in a way that like, I think it's important for me to know where I'm from. And I think part of what I'm doing today is to kind of like honor my my heritage, my Congolese heritage, and tell it in a way that is a little bit different than how it's always told. So there's always a narrative around Africa or people from Africa that might not always be accurate. And I want to kind of be able to tell a different story. And my story is like, yeah, one of like, yes, I might be from Congo, I might be from African, but I'm also a citizen of the world and I've traveled and lots of different things like that.
So on the topic, so I'm in a very similar situation. So like backstory to me is born here in the UK, but family is of Nigerian descent, and I am therefore of Nigerian descent. And then you struggle with two things. The first being first aware that the country by which you're growing up in isn't your native country. And you find like the differences in, you know, simple things such as like child rearing from an African point of view and maybe a Western point of view. And then you have those two different ideologies, like which is the ideology that your parents can raise you to grow up with. And then you're sent to school and you have a new ideology. And it was always that like constant battle between the two. Mm-hmm. And I, like myself, like many other people who I've spoken,
I totally hear what you say. Yeah.
Feel that like somewhat like disconnection of, you know, there's Africa, which you're maybe one or two steps removed from, but you still feel connected, but the roots aren't as strong as you'd like them to be. Mm-hmm. And there's the West, which you reside in, you're born in, it's the first language maybe you learn to speak, but you're aware that it's not like your own culture. So you're kind of stuck in this middle place of trying to reconnect with your heritage and maybe to some degree, like disconnect from the heritage which you've been forced to learn.
That's an interesting point. And I think that you're completely right. A lot of us or a lot of people like us with similar type of backgrounds probably have that feeling always kind of like being in the middle. Mm-hmm. In my case, it's even like, so I'm here and part of my family is in the West, but my parents are back there. Most of my siblings, after studying and living for a long time abroad, have decided to go back. So I'm still very much connected in the way, in the sense that I'm there every year, at least once a year. Now, even more so since I'm closer compared to when I was in New York. And it's something that you always, as you say, you're always in the middle and you always feel like you're one and not enough of one or not enough of the other. And it can be struggling. Honestly, I've like had that thought for a long time. Nowadays, like 2 days in time, I've decided like I don't have to choose. And I think that's also the problem. We're always kind of like forced to choose. Either you're from Congo or Nigeria or you're from the UK or Belgium. Like, we don't have to choose because we cannot choose. Like, it's both, I like to say, like, both of the cultures, both of the history is ingrained in me. I feel very much African, very much Congolese, but I also feel very much European. Mm-hmm. And I mean, my friends, for example, people that know me well, we joke about it because I always like, I'm a we everything. We Europeans, we Africans, we people from the developing country, we people from the first. I claim it all because I can, and that's true. Half my life is African and half my life is European. And I think it's what makes it hard is having to choose, and it's almost impossible to choose. And why would we?
So to play devil's advocate, the why would me or why would we that I considered? Because once you take a step back and look at like history and historically, you know, if we look at these two different ideologies, historically what one ideology has done to the other oppress and suppress. It's for me anyway, you take a step back and you think, do I really want to belong to an ideology that it's based upon the oppression of others? Is that somewhere which I'd like to call home? And most cases, I think, you know, the answer I came to was no. So that choice was very simple and easy for me to make. But again, as you quite rightly said, it's I don't think a choice is forced upon everybody. I mean, some people do make the decisions themselves. I think in life, there's always good and bad on these two ends of the spectrum. I think, you know, what is good can also be bad, and what is bad can also be good. And I think you have to, you know, take the best from both, and, you know, mix those all together, and then you have this weird concoction, and that's kind of where we sit. But for myself, there's always been a disconnection, and being here in the West, you just always have this affinity to Africa as a whole. And then, you know, you maybe are fortunate enough to have some visits back home, maybe once, twice a year, maybe a little bit more like infrequently than that. And in my personal opinion, only across the last maybe 18 to 24 or so months, there's been this real focus on like wanting to go back. Because if you were to speak to any of my friends, if we were planning on trips to any country outside of the UK, nobody has ever said in any group chats, hey, I mean, up until quite recently, hey, let's go to Africa. It's always, let's go to, you know, somewhere in Europe or like Dubai or some culture that is not our own. And I think, you know, maybe it's, we don't have an appreciation for our own culture, and maybe growing up in the West, our ideology of, you know, what good looks like has been, you know, it's a bit more from a European, Eurocentric point of view. And we've actually yet to really appreciate the beauty that is in Africa, because like, so many different places, every single country is so different, but at the same time, so similar.
It is different. Africa is huge.
And I just want to travel every single country and experience the differences in how different people make their jollof rice, to the different dialects spoken in those particular countries, just everything. And that's really my focus post-corona lockdown, is spend more time in Africa.
And I totally like recommend to you, like, and I haven't seen even like I've seen only a small part of it, but I think it's, you say several things that are right. I think definitely if you've grown up in the West and not have had a lot of chances to go there and to reconnect more directly with like back home over the continent, you probably have an image that is like distorted, because if you look at like the image of Africa from the West, maybe it's like evolved, it has evolved over time, thank God, but it's still very minimizing. It's still very not so much representative of what Africa is now. So you will have a different thing, but I think we sit in a very good spot, because, and you said it yourself, like we can take the, and each side will have good and bad, but we can take the good or the best of each and make it a known concoction. And we are a very good place to be able to show that different side of Africa, and because we know how to speak both language in a way. And I'm not talking like language or everything, but like the language of the West, and we can learn better, and we can make understand people in Africa better, the like the West. So it's kind of like we are able to connect the dots, like build this bridge between the two for a more balanced interaction between the two cultures.
And I guess that moves quite nicely to like what you currently have focused your time, energy, and effort into right now.
Yes, it is.
So I'd love to learn.
That's part of it.
So I'm somewhat interested in art. I mean, everybody has this somewhat like a very entry level understanding of art. And if you were to go to like the Tate Modern or anywhere, any gallery by which you go to view art, I mean, you just read the signs, right? That's my experience. But when I look at pieces of art from Africa, there's always been that, you know, draw to them. And even now I've, you know, started to look at art pieces to buy, to collect, just as like investment vehicles. And I thought like, all these artists and art styles I'm looking to invest in are all like European. There must be some like cool African art. And then you go into like a whole journey, like, oh wow, this is fucking, excuse my language, this is so beautiful.
Yes, no, there is a lot. And that's the thing, like, as we were saying, it's a huge continent. There are a lot of different countries with different cultures, with different histories, with different stories. And this like provides a huge good supply for creativity. And Stephanie said so much in the history of our creativity has always been there. There are a lot of talents all across Africa. A lot of like beautiful things that are being made in different form of art, whether it be painting, photography, sculpture, but it hasn't been much visible in those, and I'm talking more recent type of art, like modern and contemporary. Mm-hmm. And you know, people think about African art, or at least for the long time, that's how it was. All of those things that were used in like in rituals usually, and that were usually taken away from by colonizers and like brought here to into museums and everything. But ever since that time, there's been like the world of like the Africa has not stopped. There are a lot of very good schools. There are a lot of like different ways of like people have been doing a lot of now in the past few years that it started to kind of like come to light. And art industry, art market in general has been taking notice, and it has a lot of different events has happened to where we are today that is making art in the art world. So if you're thinking about it, investment, there's obviously never a guarantee that an art piece is going to go in value of, or not. But it's definitely like an area of the market that has been growing years, is getting more and more attention, momentum. And it was about time, I think.
Sure.
It has always, it was just not represented as well.
So how did you find yourself interested in art initially? What was that, that first journey into the world of art?
So it was through my parents. My parents have collected beautiful art from Muslim, but a few. So I grew up around it. I grew up around beautiful art. I grew up with the idea exactly with it. I had a lot of beautiful, talented artists and beautiful art around. And then when I started to travel, and to see places and visit museums, because I've always been interested in everything like cultural and lifestyle and everything. But then you realize an art is not represented in all those places you go to, like museum, unless it's a traditional like museum that have some traditional mask and lenses and experience, but that's not kind of like how I saw, at least that was my experience. I had seen much more about than that. So I realized, I started to recognize that presented abroad at home as well. And there were a lot of things, like a lot of talent that we could offer to the rest of the world. This is something that always kind of like was my mind. And everywhere I would live, I would always like to have a piece of home. So I would always have, I started like buying or having a pieces every time I would go to Congo, and then I would bring back. I have like, I have a painting, for example, here in my flat in London that is since the beginning when I was living in Congo, and then when I was in Latin America, and then in Iran. So it's just with me all the time to just have like that piece of home. And I think it's something that you and me that are not like that are from Africa, have that African heritage but live abroad, would like to have. So bringing all of that together, knowing like my passion and knowing the potential that there was that was out there, and knowing that it was finally getting ready to kind of like up this art and make like give it a space. Market, maybe it was a good thing about it.
So you've mentioned a lot of traveling, which is awesome. Recently, I've started recently, in the last 18 or so months. Again, a lot of things have changed in the last 18 or so months. Started to travel more and exposure to some cool places. So like you mentioned it, New York. So you've managed to spend a lot of time in Belgium, Colombia, New York. I'd love to know, in your former life, you were a banker. Like most people here, especially from like Afro-Caribbean communities, that is their dream goal, but probably their dream job and dream goal for, depends on how you view this, the right or wrong reasons. Normally it's due to like the financial compensation that, you know, bankers can earn. How did you find life as a banker?
So actually I was not a banker. I was a banker, but it was a long, long time ago. But at the beginning of my career, I started more in the finance, but I switched. So I worked for a few financial institutions, but I was actually, my focus was more on marketing. Then it switched to digital marketing and digital integration, customer experience and everything. And you are right. A lot of us, like the banking or like financial industry is still one that like interests a lot of people. And I think, yes, there's probably a part of it is like financial. The financial rewards that might come with it, and it's not in a role either. The other thing is also, I think it's, in a way, it's cultural. Like there's also still that kind of image of like being a banker or being a lawyer or being a doctor are like real profession. Those are real career, those are real job. And I think especially for people coming from Africa or a lot of like emerging countries or emerging like those type of cultures, there's still, you go tell your friends that I want to be an artist, they're going to be like, what are you talking about? You're going to be a doctor, a lot of us have gone through it. So I think there's definitely still that happening are changing, and it's like, it's generational as well. I think you ask a lot of like the young 18 years old and you say, what do you want to turn, am I going to be? I'm going to be like, I don't know, an Instagram influencer. And I'm like, what the hell is that? But so things are changing. Things are changing slowly.
So that transition from being a banker to a marketer, how did that come about? Where did that interest in marketing come from?
It started like as an undergrad, I studied economics. I studied economics with like an emphasis more on the business side of things. Mm-hmm. And coming out of college, obviously it was like, okay, what do I do? And banking seemed like the obvious choice. You studied economy and like banking is fine. So I started there, but I think I quickly realized that it was just not something I was excited about, that I wouldn't see myself doing that for years and years. And I still remembered from my studied years and the internship I had done that I actually liked the more commercial or the marketing side of things, because I've always liked to have a bit of creativity in what I do. Full disclosure, I wish I was an artist myself. I wish God has given me a lot of talents, but not those. I cannot draw. I do sing a lot, but poorly. I cannot paint. So since I couldn't do that, I still always wanted to have something like creative in my life. And so marketing seemed like, okay, it was still like in my skill sets on the business with the business side, but then it allowed to do something a little more creative. So how that's how I kind of like got into that, and I got lucky enough to be able to kind of like switch career and find a new opportunity to what I wanted to do. And it came with also like moving countries, which is what I wanted. So that's how I switched from one to the other. And then, so it was initially like traditional type, do an MBA. And then after the MBA, the idea was actually, I still wanted to do marketing, but I saw that like marketing was shifting, or the world was shifting online. Mm-hmm. Everything was getting digital. And so I wanted the next phase of my career to focus more on that, like the technology and the digital aspect of marketing and what was done. And it was even better because it really, like when you look at digital compared to traditional marketing, digital brings a set of like, you can measure, you can analyze, you mm-hmm. can, you get data, information. And that like appealed to my analytical side of like the economist part of in me. That was very, very happy to see more kind of like analytics and numbers coming out of the digital world. So that's what I focused for the last almost decade.
So you made like two really interesting points. The first was points that I found extremely interesting. The first was moving away from one country to another for work. And I'd love to like spend mm-hmm. some time on like the fears, nervousness of fundamentally packing up your whole life into like a series of suitcases, maybe one, two or three, and having to like set up shop in a new country with perhaps no friends, and how you managed to do that. And secondly, it's not having the gifts of a traditional artist, because I feel your pain. I never saw myself as a creative person. I remember getting the only subject that I got terrible grades in was art. Every other subject I was competent at or quite good at. But recently I found my way to be like creative, and that is in essence photography. But I'd love to spend time on packing up from one country to another for work. Why was there perhaps you seem quite happy to do so? So why was there perhaps an eagerness to do so, and how did you find like settling into a new place?
Hello. I think I lost you for the last 5 or 10 seconds. I think.
Ah, how did you find moving into a new country? Yeah.
So yeah, that was the question. So moving into that's been interesting a few times by now.
You're an expert.
But I think I've always had like, I know, weirdly, yes, I am. But I think, yeah, it's part of my personality as well, my nature. I've always been kind of like how an explorer, like adventurous, my family or friends would say. So I actually wanted to, when I moved the first time, so going from Belgium and to Colombia, I wanted an experience, like an international experience that was not Europe or Africa, which I already knew. So I wanted something different. And by way of luck and also me being bold, and I identified an opportunity and I went for it. So I moved, and it was a very interesting thing because, like, it's back in the day, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna move. So you have to tell your parents that, like, okay, I'm gonna move to another country. It's Colombia, is and everything. Back in the day, everybody I told that I was moving to Colombia was like, what? Are you, what are you talking about? For me, it was actually, I found it. I already spoke Spanish because I already had, like, I had done. Hello?
Hello. Missed you. You said you'd already spoken Spanish.
Out of the room for a second. Yes, I already spoke Spanish because I had done like exchange student in Spain. At least that. And I knew people that were from Colombia, but that didn't really live there. But to my adventure, I found it extremely exciting. So I packed my bags, all ready to go. And I still remember very clearly the day I arrived. I arrived there. I don't know the country. I don't know anything. I don't know anyone, actually, that's true. And the company I was working for had arranged to like pick me up at the airport. So I go to the airport and they was placing me in like an apartment for the first few weeks until I could find. And I remember being there and at some point coming out on the balcony and looking at the city and realizing where I was. And I was like, oh my God, what am I doing here? Because it felt, you know, at that time it felt I'm so far away from home. I'm so far away from everything I know. And I got a little bit of a freak out that moment, but that passed pretty fast. As I said, I knew people that were from Colombia and they were amazing. They kind of like set me up with some of their friends or their family to take care of me for the first few days and things like that. So it went on really well. And I've done that a few times after, and then I moved to Panama, and then I moved back to Europe, and then I moved to New York, and now here. So I guess it's not something that scares me anymore. But I also do know now that it's not something that is always easy. It's not an easy thing to do.
How did you manage to like maintain those? Social media, I guess, has probably made it easy. How did you manage to maintain those relationships with people that you've met in these new countries? You're there for maybe, you know, 18 to 24 months, and then you go off to a different place. How have you found maintaining those relationships?
So yeah, definitely social media has helped a lot. Like by the time I moved for the first time, like really moved. And going hard was in 2007, so that's right when Facebook started. So that has helped a lot. I try to be good at that too, keep in touch with people and like just sending a little something, a little message from time to time, because yeah, it matters to me. From like, I was lucky enough to get a lot of very good friendship from out of all this. And you never know who you will meet. And that's actually a very fun one. When I moved to London, I reconnected with a friend that was a friend years ago, back when I was living in Spain, and we were both doing our Erasmus there, like for a year. And then we kind of like lost each other. He was from Germany and I went back to Belgium, and then we continued our lives. But we kept in touch through social media, just like randomly. And then I realized years after, when I was living in New York, that he was working in the same company of a good friend in New York. So we met in New York. And then when I moved here, I realized he was living here. Wow. So we reconnected here, and now we're hanging out very often. So you never know. You might like find people you met like 10, 15 years ago again. And so, yeah, it's good. Social media has been great for that.
And also from a digital marketing point of view, so I spent some time like freelancing and doing some influencer marketing. I love how social media has led to an increase in like user-generated content. So I'm somewhat tired of like brands sharing like content which, you know, their in-house content team has created that's like so perfect and like it doesn't really appeal to me. And the fact that, you know, your everyday person, so to speak, can like create their own content, it's actually like awesome to see, especially around like influencer marketing. And some of these influencers are like so creative with content that they create. In fact, this lockdown period, I have been converted from like Instagram story ads at least 5 times. So first time me seeing an ad, I've just clicked and bought stuff because like, I don't know, I was just so enticed.
That's how it works. Yeah, no, I'm sure like digital marketing or digital ads have not performed as well as like in those last few months in the whole history of digital ads, because people are online all the time, and that's why you just go and like you switch and look for things. So you find something and you click on it. This is very interesting, but I think this is also something that's gonna like last even more so after the lockdown. Digital is definitely getting stronger and stronger, and social media are getting stronger. Like people you would not see on Instagram 6 months ago are now like flipping and sending you memes every time, every day. Like you're like, okay. So this is interesting to see. There's a lot to do there. And in terms of branding and marketing, as you mentioned, brands that like always try to postpone content, I think it's fair. It's fair for the brands to do that. It's fair for every company to do that, but not everybody does it well. You have to know like what type of content, and putting content just for the sake of putting content is not very useful. You have to make sure that like anything that you put is actually adding value, and those are the ones that like kind of stand out and convert more customer and more ambassadors than anything else.
What are your favorite one or two brands who are, you know, amazing in their digital marketing game, like really putting out content that one provides value and two entices and engages their whatever their niche audience is? Well, my favorite is probably Innocent Smoothie. I don't know, everyone says that, but I just love their social medias.
Yeah, no, interestingly enough, and that depends. I'm not even thinking just about like social media, and I guess it's gonna be good for you, but I think like CityGirl has been doing a good job. I do, because like I came across CityGirl not knowing it. It's not like someone told me about it and everything. So I was looking for some information about startups and legal aspect of startup, and I came across one of the articles and I found it good. So I read more articles, and that's kind of how I did it. And I found myself recommending reading like some articles from your blog to another entrepreneur friend a few days ago. So those type of things is what I mean when I say like just putting like interesting content or like things that bring value to people. And it can be definitely on social media and on Instagram. And on Instagram, it's going to be great. But at the same time, on Instagram, like each platform or social media has its limitations. So obviously, Instagram is more about like visual thing that you can put. But there are like many ways and forms to do. And in the professional world, I think putting out good article and having a good like blog or magazine can be like, can prove extremely, extremely useful.
So again, like providing like useful, so how CityGirl, it's very interesting. So how it's described is CityGirl is supposed to be your local drug dealer for all your legals. So you go into the website or the blog, and I think more companies should do this approach. It's actually quite interesting. You just give away free content, informative content, actionable content around pain points that people generally want answers to. And then what happens is, as you mentioned before, you find your potential users sharing content with their friends and similar predicaments, people actually using the platform for whatever service it provides. And now you've already built that first layer of trust based upon, information you put out has to be accurate for sure. But once the information is accurate and actually provides value, you have that trust. And then you position yourself as, you know, industry experts. And then whenever people have questions, they come to you. And then the website itself and the blogs and the content you put out in whatever form you decide to put it out then becomes quite long tail, because you have people come into your platform or to your website to have answers to those questions which you answered like years ago. And it's just really a great source of traffic also. Also from a branding point of view too, people love listening to industry experts talk. And some companies who do that are well, as another company called Afref, who are an SEO platform. They give away so much free content in regards to how to be more SEO optimal. I'm on their blog like, every day trying to find new information. I'm yet to even buy any of their products. And that's actually probably not their ideal customer. But I guess more companies should probably take that approach of just value first and then see what happens on the back end.
Yes, no, completely. And there are like, you have to think about like your marketing strategy as like really an integrated part. It's going to come in different like force and different like aspect. And you have to manage your channels and your audience sometimes differently, but it all comes together. And you have to also think about like the different stages of your users or your customers. So obviously as we said, by offering like free content, you're working more on like really that long tail and like, or top of the funnel where like most people come. But then you also have to have like a different strategy to make sure that those people like convert, and then a different strategy for making sure that those people are loyalists and like ambassadors for you. So it's different aspect. And that's the thing too, that's the, like there's another side, like a darker side of this whole like digital, and especially with what's happening now, that is happening, everybody is like think it's digital and becoming digital, or having a strategy is just like putting a website or having a presence. But it's not just that, like it's a really like coordinated effort and strategies that go for different stages, different audiences. And yeah, it's a lot to do, and it's like it takes time, and definitely not everybody does it well. But it's a process, and it's interesting to see. And what I love about the digital aspect of it is that you can almost measure every and every different thing. With the right tools, you can see exactly what is happening and make better decisions based on that.
So I enjoy it. So I have, in the past, I did some like go-to-market strategies from like very, very small startups, and I didn't realize how important branding was. I mean, it sounds so childish to say, but I take a step back and I think of all the work we did to actually come up with a brand. So hours spent on brand guidelines, things as granular as like colors. What is the primary color? What are the secondary colors? What are the support colors? What tone of voice? Like what images we're using? All of that went in. And then when you take a step back and you look at, you know, to some degree, the finished product, even though like no brand is ever finished product, because it's always a developing and evolving thing. You take a step back and you realize from a sheet of paper or a PDF I created, this brand has become an idea to like a living, breathing thing. To, you know, the ideal position to be in is to have those loyalists, you know, diehard fans of your brand who, you know, for example, go to events or pop-ups you have, or listen to your podcast, yeah. Or, you know, some brands or have crazy fans who have tattoos. It's like, oh wow, like what about the brand like really spoke to people? And ultimately, I think it's some brands have seen success with really outlining like what their values are, and not compromising on what those values are. And I think the main thing, and I guess this is more from a millennial point of view anyway, one of the main things that draws like millennial individuals to brands is not only price. I think it's the brand's values and their stances on maybe it's socioeconomically or political ideal or topics. And we're seeing some brands who've like doubled down and said, these are our values. Here's what we believe in. And as a result, that has created like somewhat like cult followings for those brands. And other brands who are a bit, you know, flippy floppy and don't really want to take a side, you know, they've kind of like lost their respect or their footings in the eyes of a young consumer.
Yeah, no, completely. And branding is super important. And the thing is, like, it's hard to, because people see it like it can be fluffy, and that's true. That's an intangible concept. But it actually, you can put a value on it. Like when you think about and basic brands, like an example that everybody would know, like you put like a Apple. Apple has great product. Do they have much better product than Samsung or nope. You? Why, hey, like, no, they don't. But they can afford to put a premium just because of the brand. And you have that in every industry and in everything. And especially, I think, in this world where so many things are possible to do by yourself, like anybody can start a company and a business and sell on Amazon today and everything. So you have like a lot of options, a lot of offers and a lot of noises. The ones that really stand out are the ones that have a strong and cohesive brand. And those are the ones that like have the most, like bring the most value and have the most loyalists. And you were saying like hardcore followers. Those are extremely valuable, especially in this age of like social media. A hardcore follower, like you can have, or you can do something good and you have like one follower that is himself a follower, and within one day you gain like, I don't know, 10,000 followers just because of something you've done. So I do think it's extremely important for everyone who wants to start and build something like in the long run or something big, will need to start with defining clearly what is your brand, what do you stand for, what is your why, and make sure that you have those clear before you go to market, because there are like tons of competition for everything.
So you said it, which is providing value is probably one of the most important elements. And with some of the clients I've worked with in the past, one of the main issues they have is they have a brand, they have a product, they have a service, they know quite clearly, you know, who they are. But when it comes to putting content out, like all content needs to have a purpose. And you have some content that is purposes, you know, educational, some is to, you know, entertain. And those mm-hmm. in themselves are forms of value. But some companies find it very difficult to actually outline, you know, what is the value that we're going to provide to our users, to our social media followers, to anybody who sees our campaigns. And in your experience, what is the best way to, one, outline, you know, what that value is, and whether there's multiple pieces of value to be determined?
I think in my world, it would be two things that come to mind. First of all, and most importantly, listen to users, listen to consumers, put it out there and getting as much feedback. And you can get it in different ways. Like obviously you have the qualitative, but quantitative as well. And that's like the second part of my answer is measure. Like you might start with not knowing or not having access to like a focus group or someone that can give you a feedback, but then try different things and see how people respond to that. And you can do that online. But even in general, even offline, you should always try to get like feedback. Who are you trying to reach? And what are they saying? What do they need? So it's also, and that's part of like, I think for a lot of the brands, and I think the very successful ones are definitely the ones that have a conversation with their customer, and not just like telling their customer stuff, but it's a two-way discussion. So you have to always have that two-way discussion and being open to how the market is responding to whatever you're putting out, and being open to receive that feedback and apply it.
I agree. can't be that. Do any brands come to mind in regards to brands who are conversational with their content?
I'm trying to think about, there are plenty, but I'm trying to think about like something here. Like I think brands like in the new like financial, like brands like Revolut and Monzo, sure. Mm-hmm. Like those new challengers, I've been good at doing that, at listening and creating a kind of like communities around their services and around their audiences where people can just say whatever they want and suggest new things and suggest new features and things like that. And they try to they apply it also on social media and everything. And I think that's definitely a smart way to do it. And they've also come, both of them, with like kind of a strong branding and strong identity, to which, as you said, like is really appealing, especially to the millennial generation and the younger ones.
I agree. Those are very interesting examples, because one of the reasons why, you know, other financial institutions, particularly banks, haven't had content geared towards maybe younger demographics is like regulation. And from a regulatory stance, the things you can say and you can't say in your marketing. But like these challenger banks have seemed to like just like throw regards to the wind, and it's great. For example, like most of their consumers will be, you know, Revolut, for example, is quite heavily male dominated. They won't tell you the numbers. But they kind of alludes to it, like, and it's your, you know, 20 to 30 year old like male probably working in the city who has like their silver card, who they're paying like £10 or whatever it is per month, and all their content is speaking directly for the most part like to him or to her. And you have other challenger mm-hmm. banks who have, you know, content themed around like what's popular in like young pop culture, and it's really interesting to see these brands have like clearly attacked a demographic which to some degree was alienated, untouched, disenfranchised, and it just made them their own. And it's so funny to watch, you know, your traditional banks now try to jump on the bandwagon.
Of all, to jump on the
years,
wagon.
Years too late. Like, and yeah.
Not really.
For example, like it's so ludicrous to think that. So I tried to set up another bank account quite maybe a year or so ago. And I was told I needed to go to the bank to set a bank account up.
Yeah.
And I was like, and then it confused me as to why I needed to do so. And then I set up an app with like, was it Monzo? I did it on my phone remotely. I had a phone, I had my card come to me maybe 2 days before I went on holiday. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. So why did I need to go to the bank in the first place? I'm so confused.
That is so true. And the same happened to me when I moved to London, because I arrived and I was like, okay, I know by now after my whatever X moves, I know what I need to do first and stuff. And I was like, okay, bank account I need. And same as you, oh, you have to. And here it was even more complicated, because to go to the bank, I needed to have something else. Like, I mean,
yeah, when like you're coming from another dress country. And all this other stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like it's something else. And I was like, oh my God. And then I knew about, I have a Lute and Monzo, having worked in the financial industry, I keep kind of like knowing, and in the fintech, I keep like, you know, reading about what's happening. So I knew about them. So I was like, okay, let's give it a try. And yeah, same as you. Within a few minutes, my account was set up. 2 days after, my card was here. And I was like, yeah. And it reminded me of my time in the financial industry. And I was like, wow. And I remember when you would have to make a decision about a small thing and it would take like 6 months. This was something else. So it's advancing, and it's advancing very fast. But I think, yes, those type of companies that really understood how to speak to the audience they're after, how to provide their content, and how to have that like ongoing conversation with them. And the older companies are trying to adapt to it with more or less success.
So what I had the pleasure of talking to a SaaS founder who set up his SaaS company in like the year I was born, so like maybe like 96. And I was like, whoa, you were doing SaaS back in like back in the cowboy days, back when back when SaaS was like really, really super difficult to actually do. And he said back then it was very, you know, product and sales, so very sales focused.
Yes.
It was about you having like super, you know, somewhat aggressive people on the phone, pounding away, trying to get people to actually arrange to have meetings and things of that nature. And now we look at, you know, SaaS, for example, as a bit more of a product focused service. And it led me on a thought process, which is we've actually seen one of the most interesting things about like marketing and digital marketing primarily is that element of community. And like some companies' USP is purely just their community. Like there's some industries, there's very little differentiation between like product and services. All that is different is just the brand and then the community. And the community is, in essence, in most cases for some companies, and what we're seeing is if you go to like any digital marketing seminar, they'll tell you the power of community. You focus on growing your community. The community is like really one of the most important elements of any companies these days.
It is. Well, think about Facebook. Facebook was just started, and Facebook is what it is because it started by building a very strong community, and that is like now monetizing on that community. Mm. But for the longest time, it was not even about monetizing at all. So once you get to that point where you have that community, you have a lot of different options opening to you. And that's, as you said, I think nowadays, like the power of your brand and your community is really gonna influence how you're gonna do, or even like how you'll be evaluated as a company and all those different things. So this is very important. And you were like mentioning that the SaaS industry, or we were talking about the financial industry, but it's interesting because even in the art industry, I'm seeing a lot of those things as well happening, because the art industry for hundreds of years have operated in a certain way. Mm-hmm. You know, like, often the elite and the patrons working on a one-on-one with like an art dealer or a gallery, and it's all very secretive, and it's really like a one-on-one. You call your client, your little base of clientele, and all those like different things. And it's also one of those industries that has resisted for a very long time to to go digital and to go online. And actually this crisis that we're going through now has awakened so many people in the industry about, oh my God, because now, right now, if you want to sell art, it's online. So you have to figure it out. And so it's kind of this realization, and it's interesting for me to see, because I've had that my ID like about like a year, and then started working on it a few months ago, and a lot of the time I've heard that thing, yeah, but you know, for art it's not gonna work, like it's like online, it's not gonna work, it's still like a in-person type of transactions. In my head I'm like, no, I don't think so. The world is changing, and the world has changed, and it's gonna go online. So I'm just like being proven my point, which is always nice to see.
It's good to be.
It's always good to be right. But it's the same happening there, and it's gonna be interesting to see how the different actors in the industry, big and small, are gonna adapt to it. Some are gonna probably have more struggles than others.
Very good point about art, because I have a few friends who are artists, and they have some of their work at, you know, showed on exhibitions. And then I'd ask them about, like, you know, revenue they're making from their art, because, you know, you always have this idea of like a starving artist who is their brilliance isn't seen until, unfortunately, they pass away. And when they pass away, their art is sold for millions, and all the revenue they generate from the art's being sold goes to some foundation. Right? I told my friend a story, and he says, yeah, so, you know, I show my work at this exhibition, the gallery, they take, you know, 50% of any money I make. And I was like, whoa, that's a lot. Can't you maybe just sell your art online? And he's like, no, but you know, I don't have access to like the high net worth individuals to sell my art. And I think that is, again, like a lot of this is like the mental traps industries play on those who they exploit. And that like story which he told me, I'm sure is one that his gallery told him as to why he shouldn't go elsewhere, and why they should take half his money, is the idea that he doesn't have access to like high net worth clients. So how would you sell your art? You don't want to be a starving artist. You know, 50% is better than 0%. And I think this shift, one, coronavirus, but two, just a shift to digital, and a shift direct to consumer, is going to open the world to so many different, you know, individuals like my friend here, who have the power, once they cultivate that following, so to speak, to actually sell their products and services directly to their consumers, and like bypass the middleman. And it's going to be interesting to see not only how they manage to bypass the middleman, so to speak, but what those middlemen do to maybe entice them to stay, or what those middlemen do to actually change with the times.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's going to be interesting, because that's true, artists could go like direct to consumers, but I think there is an importance to the world of like the galleries, the role that the galleries play, and the big collectors and the dealers and everything. There is a place for them, for sure. Now that place just needs to be adapted, but they should still be there, maybe or operate differently. And especially like the high net worth individuals will probably always do like business in a different way than like the majority of people. But at the same time, it needs not to always be only focused on the high net worth people. Like there are a lot of people that are interested in art and that don't have also this access. They would want to have this access to the artist or the artwork or different galleries, but it is an intimidating world. So I think it's, as you said, it's going to be very interesting to see how the industry adapts. But at the same time, it's exciting. With like every kind of like big challenges come a lot of like great opportunities and a great, like great genius out of it.
That's a very good point. Speaking of it being, you know, maybe intimidated, I remember going to my first private art exhibition, and you know, I walked in, they gave me a few glasses of wine. I looked around, I didn't see anybody who looked like me. I didn't see anybody who talked like me, sounded like me. Everybody had a French accent. Like, I don't know why everyone had to have a French accent or a very, very posh British accent. And they were talking in these, you know, abstract, esoteric terms about the art, and I didn't know what they were talking about.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, you know, and I thought, this is part of the game. This is, you know, everyone is speaking in this way because they all understand, and it was clear in groups and out groups, and I was clearly part of the out group. And I thought, is this what people need to do? Is this a particular language and dress code to maybe get into that in-group? Is this what art is? Is this the in-groups versus the out-groups?
That's a lot of what it has been, what it's always been. But that's also one of the things that I would like to see different. Because, and you say, like, you go somewhere, like, nobody else looks like you. Yes. It happens often. And just, like, even representation, the reason, like, also why we're doing, like, Pavilion 54 was that it's interesting to see that, like, African art is growing and it's trending and it's selling more than ever before. But you can still not see many African people being in the front of that movement. In terms of like gallery, you have some, but like it's very limited. And like representation is important as well. Like, so people can identify, or like, as you say, going to an event and not everybody speak with my accent or with a very posh British accent, and so on and so forth. So I think those are things that needs to be changed. I think needs to be changed because one of the challenges also of the art industry, a lot of like actors in the market are facing is like, there's not enough, they always need new buyers or new collectors, but they need to increase the reach, they need to increase the clientele. And you're not going to do that by continuing that idea of like us versus you and like we're the cool group, like the in-group and the out-group. You're going to do that by making it more accessible, more transparent, and more open and diverse. That's how you're going to bring in more people. And that's how you're going to bring a younger crowd as well.
So like most industries, and I read a lot of pitch decks, and like some of the buzzwords you see are like democratizing access to this, and yes. it does sound ultimately like that is what like the art industry needs, is to democratize access to art for your everyday person.
It is, I think democratize, I don't know if it's the right word, because democratize also implies that like you make it like kind of, it goes with the idea of like it's everything and anything, and maybe lowers the value as well. I don't know if it's democratized, but making it like more approachable, more accessible, more open. As you say, like the idea of like always talking about art with some like every word and very fancy words and an expression that like, general person is like, what the hell are you talking about? I'm not sure it's very inviting. I'm not sure like most people respond to it. It's maybe actually I outdated as well. So not democratizing, and it's also educating people properly, because I think a lot of the intimidation comes from like the opacity of the industry in general. But yeah, people feeling like, I don't know anything about it. I don't know anything about art. And even if you want to buy an art piece and it's maybe like £1,000, you're like, I don't even know if it's worth £1,000. How can I know if
that's a good point? Like, I've been in that situation before.
Exactly. and so education, and it's like, yeah, everybody has it. And education is extremely important. And I know that like that's something we want to put a big emphasis on, and like educating, like so people, without using fancy jargon and buzzwords or whatever, explain, okay, what should you think about when you want to buy art? Or there's something that you like, how can you evaluate that it's a good deal or not? Like, you know, small things that makes it just more accessible and more approachable for more people.
I agree. So we've been speaking for almost an hour now. And
yeah.
I'd love to like leave on like one final question. And it's always my favorite one to like ask, but also to listen to. If you could speak to maybe a 19, 18 year old version of yourself, what advice would you give yourself knowing what you know now?
I'd say go for it. Don't be, don't worry about everybody thinking, don't doubt yourself. You're as smart as most people, like most of your peer, maybe even not. So just trust your guts and go for it. Even if it's a mistake, like do it and learn from it. Just go for it.
All right. So thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Just go for it. Wow.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, pleasure. Wow. Thank you for taking some time to listen to all of that. I really appreciate it. Feedback makes the world go round. So what I'd like for you to do is please give us a follow on Instagram, bedroom2b. That's our socials. Please give me some feedback as to how we can improve. Alternatively, message me on LinkedIn. So AJ, surname is Alpha Lima Alpha Oscar. Feedback makes the world go round. So I'm eagerly anticipating how we can make the next few episodes much better. Again, thank you so much for listening and stay tuned for the next episode.